regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. So Cody Wisniewski from Firearms Policy Coalition Action Foundation was supposed to be with us on the program today, but just a couple of minutes before our interview was set to begin, he emailed me and said, hey, my internet is down. So we're going to have Cody on the program tomorrow, but we still have a lot to discuss today. In fact, before we get into our main topic, let's just kind of go through the Monday morning update here. So the Supreme Court once again had Snope and Ocean State Tactical listed for consideration in conference last week. The orders list came out Monday morning. No Snope, no Ocean State Tactical. So presumably those cases will be relisted for, I believe, the 15th time for Snope. I mean, this is really getting into unprecedented territory in terms of the number of relists that are taking place here. So what's going on is anybody's guess. My theory, and again, I could be completely wrong here, but my theory is that the Supreme Court is waiting until the Duncan case, which is the challenge to California's ban on quote-unquote large-capacity magazines, they're waiting until Duncan gets appealed to the Supreme Court, which is going to be a matter of weeks. Then the state of California is going to have, I believe, 30 days to respond. It unfortunately could be until after the summer recess before the court has the opportunity to consider Duncan in conference. But if they want to take two cases, sort of, you know, combine these cases together, one dealing with bans on so-called assault weapons, one dealing with bans on so-called large capacity magazines, that would be the way to do it, right? Now, Ocean State Tactical versus Nerona, that's been up before the Supreme Court. That's a challenge to Rhode Island's ban on quote-unquote large-capacity magazines as well. But that is an appeal regarding the denial of a preliminary injunction. And we've seen before that the Supreme Court has not wanted to weigh in on these cases until you know, a case has been tried on the merits. And even then, they haven't always wanted to accept these cases. Now, that doesn't explain why they didn't just deny Ocean State Tactical versus Nerona. That is a little confusing. Presumably, if they're waiting on Duncan, they would grant cert to Snope and Duncan. They would, place Ocean State Tactical versus Nerona officially on hold until after those cases have been decided. Or again, they would take action then, maybe in granting that injunction, which would be a preview of what might happen with the gun and magazine ban cases. Or they could simply deny that request for an injunction. Although, again, why they haven't done so before now would be anybody's guess. So my theory is that we are not going to see any action on Snope for could be another few months, unfortunately. But every week that goes by and Snope gets relisted and then no action is taken, to me, makes it pretty apparent that the court is waiting for something before they issue their decision. And I suspect, I'm feeling more and more confident that they're going to grant cert to Snope at some point. Again, it's just, what are they waiting for? Well, we don't know. Now, the other big news from Monday morning is that the House Budget Committee has approved its markup of the reconciliation bill without making any changes to what was approved by the House Ways and Means Committee when it comes to, lowering the NFA tax on suppressors down to zero. So that language is still in the reconciliation bill. But it means that the language that would include the Section 2 of the Hearing Protection Act, which would actually remove suppressors from the National Firearms Act, and language from the Short Act, which would remove short-barreled firearms from the National Firearms Act, has not been adopted as part of the reconciliation bill. Now, in the House Budget Committee, there was originally a vote on Friday that failed, right? So you've got, I think it was four Republicans, members of the House Freedom Caucus, primarily they want to see more budget cuts. They say that the bill as written still adds to the deficit, that a lot of the savings kick in down the road, But in the meantime, we're spending a lot more money. So they want to see some fundamental changes. Representative Andrew Clyde from Georgia, who is also an FFL, did say on X last night that he is continuing to work to get the Hearing Protection Act language, get the Short Act language included in the reconciliation bill. It looks like the best opportunity for that to happen is going to be in the House Rules Committee. We also heard that from NRA ILA Executive Director John Comerford when we spoke to him last week. The Rules Committee is scheduled to begin its markup on Wednesday morning around 11 a.m. So if we want to see this language strengthened and not just see the tax on suppressors go from $200 to $0, but actually have the registration, the fingerprinting requirements for not just suppressors, but again, for short-barreled firearms taken out of federal statute, we've got a pretty limited window to lobby Congress. There's a coalition of Second Amendment organizations and individuals who have submitted a letter to the chair of the House Rules Committee, House Budget Committee as well, demanding that those changes be made. But now it is up to us as gun owners and Second Amendment advocates to make our thoughts known and to contact members of the House Rules Committee. Contact your own Congress critter as well. But I think it would behoove us all to focus some extra attention on those members of the House Rules Committee and say, listen, while you all are considering changes, and we know that changes will be made, or else this big, beautiful bill doesn't get out of the House, make sure that those changes include, again, the addition of the Hearing Protection Act and the Short Act language that would remove suppressors and short-barreled firearms from the National Firearms Act altogether, not just zero out the transfer taxes on suppressors. All right, so that kind of gets us caught up. One other thing I should mention, by the way, speaking of the Supreme Court, the NRA has formally filed its cert petition with the Supreme Court, appealing the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals decision upholding Florida's gun sale ban on adults under the age of 21. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that, well, it's not a complete denial of their Second Amendment rights because, you know, they can still get a gun from a family member. They just can't buy a gun at retail, which is absurd. This is a direct attack on the ability of young adults and their ability to purchase firearms. That's why the law was passed, to make it harder, if not impossible, for young adults to exercise their Second Amendment rights. So the NRA is appealing that to the Supreme Court. Again, the state of Florida has 30 days to respond. What's interesting is that Florida's attorney general has said, I don't want to defend this law. So we'll see what the state of Florida's response actually is here. It is possible that the attorney general can refuse to file a, well, couldn't refuse to file a response, but they could refuse to defend the law in its response. We saw something like this happen with a law that California Governor Gavin Newsom had signed. And Attorney General Rob Bonta declined to defend that law, saying it was unconstitutional. And in that case, the governor's office basically defended the law, which, by the way, was overturned. I don't think you're going to see Ron DeSantis argue in favor of keeping this gun sale ban in place, because he, too, has been actually lobbying for that to be repealed by the legislature. So it is going to be interesting to see what happens with the appeals process for Florida's gun sale ban to under 21s. And again, I guess we'll see what happens here in a couple of weeks. All right, now on to today's big topic of conversation, at least the longer topic of conversation. You know, Nick Cipollina, who's the president of Everytown for Gun Safety, had a letter to the editor of the Washington Post. I find it interesting, by the way, that it was relegated to a letter to the editor and not an official, like, you know, guest column. And Cipollina's letter was basically saying, yeah. Violent crime might be dropping. Yeah. Public mass shootings might be at their lowest level since 2006. But all of that can be undone based on the actions of the Trump administration. One of the things that Cipollina is complaining about, besides the shuttering of the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, is the pullback of tens of billions, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars, in federal grants to community gun violence prevention programs, right? Now, not only did we have the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, but we have seen blue states set up their own Office of Gun Violence Prevention. And in fact, in blue states, we've even seen some blue cities do the same locally. One of them, Syracuse, New York, where the Office of Gun Violence Prevention set up by the mayor is the subject of a great deal of debate in this year's mayoral race. And in fact, Syracuse.com asked all of the contenders what they thought and what they planned to do with the Office of Gun Violence Prevention. And I thought it was fascinating because, you know, Saplina's point is that he claims anyway, you know, these are common sense measures supported by all rational thinking people, right? As it turns out, there are a lot of Democrats, at least Democratic candidates for mayor in Syracuse, who are not happy with the way that this particular office has been run. And I think their complaints are valid, quite frankly. We're going to start, however, with the one Republican who was running for mayor of Syracuse, New York, Thomas Babylon, who told Syracuse.com that the city has a problem with violence, not guns. He said, here people are stabbed, beaten, or shot, or threatened with violence too frequently. The current efforts of the Office to Reduce Gun Violence are directed at violence prevention, and a more appropriate name would be the Office of Community Violence Prevention. But he said that aspects of this program are questionable. He said, especially concerning is its use of, quote, credible messengers with questionable backgrounds and a lack of training as messengers who are at-risk youth. He says the office is currently attempting to take over the local state SNUG program, and it's $1.8 million in funding. Just months ago, SNUG employees were caught selling drugs out of the Southwest Community Center. The director believes that a takeover would enhance oversight, but also admits that his office has a history of hiring unqualified individuals. Babylon added that weeks ago, the director addressed the Common Council, and in no statistics concerning the Office of Gun Violence Prevention success, he promised those numbers in the future, but also stated that success was hard to gauge. And Babylon says if it is to be sustained as an independent office of the mayor, its success must be demonstrated. Well, a version of the office, he says, is likely to continue under my administration for the purposes of managing state and federal pass-through grants. At this time, the office has been unable to articulate any success that would justify its continued existence in its current form. Now, obviously, I don't have a problem with what Babylon said. In fact, I find it very interesting. He hits on a couple of my issues with not community gun violence intervention programs in general, but with some specifically. You know, as a gun owner and a Second Amendment advocate, I am all in favor of programs that are designed to reduce violent crime without putting new laws in place, without imposing new restrictions on lawful gun owners. And that would include, by their very nature, community gun violence intervention programs. The problem, however, is that those programs do need to be transparent in where that money is being spent. And they need to be accountable in terms of what programs are actually doing. You know, all too often, it is easy for these things to become jobs programs for gun control activists. And in some cases, there is so little oversight that bad actors can actually use public funds while continuing their criminal ways. There is a program called No Guns based out of Los Angeles. And this was over a decade ago, but the founder of that program, a guy by the name of Hector Big Weasel Marroquin, a former gang member who, while receiving over $1 million in public funds, was also selling guns on the side. It was busted eventually by undercover law enforcement agents, sentenced to prison. I think No Guns received like $1.8 million in taxpayer funds. We've seen other programs, including like Ceasefire in Chicago, where they hire these violence interrupters who are still committing violence. They're still active gang members. They're drug dealers. So again, in theory, I don't have a problem with community gun violence intervention programs that are not based on putting new gun laws on the books, that are not based on putting lawful gun owners behind bars or restricting their right to keep their arms in any way. But that doesn't mean that I'm willing to write a blank check to every one of these programs that says, hey, listen, we're going to reduce gun violence without putting any new laws in place. Again, there needs to be transparency and accountability, and it sounds like Babylon believes that's not the case. there in Syracuse with the mayor's office of gun violence prevention. Now, one of the Democrats who's running for mayor in Syracuse, Pat Hogan, says that they would continue the office, but would reshape it to focus more directly on equity, prevention, and community-driven solutions, saying that gun violence is a public health crisis that we cannot police our way out of. We need to invest in people. As mayor, Hogan says, I would expand this office's partnership with trusted grassroots groups, youth mentors, violence interrupters, mental health workers, and neighborhood leaders. These are the people who are already doing the work. We should be lifting them up, not sidelining them. Well, a couple of things. I don't like referring to gun violence as a public health epidemic. In fact, it looks like right now, violent crime, including violent crime involving firearms, down substantially. Certainly over the past year, there is some evidence. I know that Dr. John Lott of the Crime Prevention Research Center thinks that the FBI statistics are not accurate, but there is some evidence that violent crime has actually been dropping at pretty precipitous rates for the past couple of years. So generally, we think of an epidemic as something that's out of control, right? Not something that is declining in nature. And in fact, in Syracuse, it appears that the violent crime is down, including crime involving firearms. So again, calling this a public health epidemic to me is an excuse to, again, impose more restrictions on lawful gun owners. And I like the fact that Hogan talks about, you know, partnerships with trusted organizations. Because again, that accountability and transparency is important, but I'm not thrilled with some of the language that Hogan used. Another Democrat running for the mayor of Syracuse, Chulma Jock, said, while they respect Mayor Walsh's intent in creating the office to reduce gun violence, they will not continue the office in its current form. It will not be housed at City Hall, saying that the strategies used by the current administration have fallen short, that they must take a new direction that addresses violence directly and builds real trust and safety in our neighborhoods. They say the current program, although well-intended, is poorly managed. Violent individuals still roam our streets, harming families and households. As Mayor Madoc says, or Majok says, my anti-violence strategy would be led by an experienced community organization in partnership with the Syracuse Police Department. My focus will be on measurable outcomes, real accountability, and partnerships that save lives. Rehabilitation services will be offered, but unlike the current administration, they will not be optional. Those who continue to bring violence to our neighborhoods will face strong and consistent consequences. Now, that language, well, Majok didn't specifically talk about Operation Ceasefire. Sure sounds like that's what they're talking about. Because with an Operation Ceasefire project, and Attorney General Jason Miara is in Virginia. We've talked with him about this before. I mean, I've championed Project Ceasefire for years now, because to me, it is an example of a community gun violence intervention program that has real results, does not impact lawful gun owners, does not involve putting new laws on the books, but again, does have a measurable impact in reducing violent crime, including crimes committed with firearms. With the Project Ceasefire model, you basically take that at-risk group of individuals, right? You identify who are those individuals in Syracuse, New York, for example, who are disproportionately at risk for creating violent crime, and those who are already committing violent crimes, many of whom are already involved in the criminal justice system. They're already on probation. And so you start there, and you call them in. And there are basically two groups of people at that call-in. There's the community side. There's everybody from, you know, again, let's call them the gun violence interrupters, pastors, teachers, people involved with, you know, nonprofits, counselors. And then on the other side, there's law enforcement. There's the Syracuse Police Department. There is the district attorney. There is the U.S. attorney, representatives from federal law enforcement. And the message from both of these groups is consistent. You're going to stop shooting. We will help you turn your life around if you let us. But if you don't, we're going to put you behind bars for as long as we possibly can. Now, you could argue that that, again, is optional in terms of these rehabilitation services. But I'd say it's only optional, again, if you don't want to take advantage of those programs and instead you want to go to trial. Because that's part of the stick approach, right? The carrot is, hey, if you'll help us, if you'll let us help you, we're going to get you job counseling. We're going to get you counseling to deal with, you know, any psychological issues that you have. We're going to do what we can to help you put your life on the right path. If you don't let us help you, then the next time you get arrested, or maybe the current charges that you're facing are not going to be pled down. In fact, if we can, we're going to refer these cases to federal court, where you'll be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, where you will have to serve at least 85% of your sentence, as opposed to 50% of your sentence. And we're going to throw the book at you, because we can't have you destroying our community anymore. And so one way or the other, you're not going to be shooting. You will either turn your life around, or you will be incarcerated for as long as we can possibly keep you behind bars. That program, which has been around since the late 1990s, look, it doesn't always work. There are a lot of moving parts. You got to have cooperation between, you know, these various community groups and law enforcement. Sometimes the egos get involved. Someone wants to take credit. And then there's also the consistency, right? You got to stick with it. You can't just do this for 6 months and then the first sign of success, say, all right, problem solved, and then you drop the program. No, you've got to continue on with this. But when these programs are successfully deployed, we've seen reductions in homicide rates of 50% or more. Just again, by focusing on that small group of core offenders. So if that is what Majak is hoping to do, I'd say that's actually a pretty reasonable approach. Now, the last Democrat who was interviewed by Syracuse.com is the only one who really like wholeheartedly embraced this current office. So Sharon Owens, who is the deputy mayor of Syracuse, once again called gun violence a public health crisis, said she wouldn't just continue the mayor's office to reduce gun violence. She would, quote, make it stronger. She says as deputy mayor, she helped lead this office from concept to execution because she knows about reducing violence, and it's not just about policing. It's about investing in people, healing trauma, and creating real opportunity. Then the office, under the leadership of Pastor Latif Johnson-Kinsey, implements coordinated strategies, which include community organizations, city, county, state, and federal law enforcement, and Saratoga County Sheriff's Department through the Syracuse Onondaga County Gun Violence Task Force, earning credibility from these experts, saying that this multifaceted approach to reducing gun violence are critical. By the end of 2024, she says, violent crime down 8.1%. Those killed or injured by guns have been reduced by 39%. To be clear, she says, gun violence demands accountability. I will continue my work with our law enforcement partners to identify people and systems contributing to the proliferation of illegal guns in our community. Which, again, to me, now you're blaming the inanimate object, right? You're not blaming the individual. It doesn't matter how many guns are in circulation. First of all, we have a right to keep and bear them. So you are always going to have firearms in this country. Now, they can be legal or they can be illegal to possess, but they're not going away. And when you make these firearms inaccessible, when you make it hard to exercise your Second Amendment rights, when you create this culture of criminality surrounding gun ownership in general, not only are you making it, I think, much more difficult, if not impossible, to have a culture of responsible gun ownership, but you, again, are making excuses for the individuals who pull the trigger. You blame it on the gun, not the person. And that, to me, is the wrong approach. But again, I find it interesting that despite the claims by gun control advocates that, you know, all of these gun violence intervention programs are just hunky-dory, they're great, they should be fully funded by the federal government, when you get down to where these programs are being put in place, you actually find some bipartisan agreement on some of the problems with these programs and the need for accountability, the need for transparency, and yes, the need to be able to show a track record of success. And if you can't do that, then what the heck are you spending this money for? So I do find it interesting that this is playing out as an issue in the Syracuse, New York mayor's race, not exactly where you would expect to find a lot of disagreement or contention with a gun control policy, but one where, yeah, even some Democrats say that the current mayor's office of to reduce gun violence is taking the wrong approach. I find that very interesting. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story. Our good deed of the day and our recidivist report will start there with a case out of Houston, Texas. Breaking bond, a 22-year-old violent offender on probation in two counties, arrested with a 16-year-old girl. This is from Fox 26 in Houston. Breaking bond is part of a regular series that they have, which I think is great, covering some of the problems with the criminal justice system. And again, repeat offenders specifically. So the most recent example of this is a guy named Damian Castillo. He's 22 years old. They say he has a history of criminal activity. He's been a fugitive in three counties since October of last year. And he has repeatedly received bond despite his extensive record. Andy Kahan with Crime Stoppers in Houston said that he doesn't blame Castillo's family members for being afraid of him. Relatives of his ex-girlfriend apparently sent an email to Fox 26 saying that they are afraid when he bonds out of jail. They appointed the 230th felony court judge, Chris Morton, who they say kept granting Castillo bond after bond, and Castillo would threaten the family every time he got out. Andy Kahan with Crime Stoppers says he violated his probation umpteenth amount of times. He had a lot of criminal charges, serious charges, that were ultimately dismissed at the request of the complaining witness. Now, listen, that's tough. If you're a district attorney, you're a prosecutor, all of a sudden your main witness recants their testimony, it is going to be difficult to put somebody behind bars. But there have been cases where Castillo ultimately saw these cases adjudicated in court. In 2022, he was sentenced to 5 years probation for deadly conduct. And as Fox 26 in Houston says, he repeatedly violated that probation, but new criminal charges have not caused his probation to be revoked. He is on probation in Travis County, Austin, Texas, for aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Andy Kahan with Crime Stoppers in Houston says the ankle monitor that he was supposed to wear ends up in a landfill in October of 2024. May 6th of this year, deputies in Harris County arrested Castillo, originally on a charge of evading arrest. Deputies say that he had two firearms legally in his possession. He had a 16-year-old girl with him as well. And now he is finally jailed with no bond. But we'll see how long that lasts. And again, plenty of opportunities to put Castillo behind bars that we're not taking advantage of. Even in the Lone Star State of Texas, where we think, you know, people are pretty tough on crime. Apparently that is not always the case there in Harris County. Now, today's Armed Citizen story from Aurora, Colorado. Don't have a lot of information here because it just happened a short time ago, but a homeowner in Aurora shooting an alleged burglar early Monday morning. So officials in the Denver suburb say it was just before 5 o'clock this morning. A homeowner was alerted to a man allegedly breaking into his detached garage. Police say that the homeowner confronted the man, at which time the shooting occurred. Alleged intruder taken to the hospital with life-threatening injuries. Police say there was no known relationship between the homeowner and the suspect. The detectives investigating the shooting. Right now, nobody's in custody. Again, don't know the circumstances here, but it sounds like this is being investigated, at least for the moment, as a case of self-defense, and hopefully we'll be able to bring you some more information on that shooting tomorrow on Bearing Arms Cam and Company. And finally today, our good deed of the day. in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A good Samaritan in New Hampshire who pulled a crash victim to safety from a burning vehicle over the weekend. Authorities in Antrim, New Hampshire, say they responded to a crash early Saturday morning, about 4:15. A single vehicle had left the roadway, had rolled over, and by the time they got there, was fully engulfed in flames. Fire department posted on Facebook, fortunately, a passerby had stopped and extricated the driver from the burning vehicle, getting him up to the roadway away from the burning vehicle. The victim had multiple abrasions, had neck and back pain, but had no burns. And thankfully, did not appear to be suffering from any life-threatening injuries. The Antrim Fire Department says that there were multiple explosions from the vehicle with ammunition and propane cylinders inside the vehicle. The fuel line of the vehicle had also ruptured, adding to the fire. An additional resource for a tanker was requested from another fire department for a backup water supply. The incident currently under investigation by Antrim Police. Now, again, the presence of propane cylinders and ammunition in the vehicle, odd. Let's say it's odd. I have certainly had, at times, in my vehicle, a firearm with ammunition and propane tanks. And I wasn't planning on doing anything nefarious. I was planning on going home and using my propane-powered smoker or my grill. And I was carrying because I generally am. However, it could be that maybe there was something a little more nefarious going on. So we will also keep our eyes on this story and see if we get any updates out of Antrim, New Hampshire. But regardless, that Good Samaritan who came upon that flaming car and pulled the driver to safety in the right place at the right time and willing and able to do the right thing, and we thank them for their very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Barron Arms Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. And hopefully, Cody Wisniewski's internet going to be back with him. And we will have Cody back on the program. Don't forget, though, you can check out BarronArms.com throughout the day. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information, including the latest from Washington, D.C., and the negotiations over the big, beautiful reconciliation bill. What kind of NFA reforms will be included in the final text? Well, again, I think a lot of that is up to us. So make sure that you contact your Congress critter today. All right. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe. And be free.